Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast.
Sorry about that. I literally had to fly in from outer space.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, is given away in the title, really. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, of how they came to be. I talk about development stories, marketing stories, production stories, post-production stories, release stories, all the bits and bobs that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love, just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The movies that I choose for this podcast, they tend to have a mainstream leaning to them, really. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I'm not really interested in punching down or going all snarky. I just celebrate the fact that it's really hard to make a film, and so I want to salute those who've done it, really. Which I think is probably enough preamble, really. I'm going to crack on with the first of the two films I'm talking about in this episode. Going to play you a clip from the trailer of it. Let's go back to 1995, and we're back in the world of James Bond.
Is the target.
72 hours ago, a secret weapon system was detonated over Savannah.
And the threat is real.
GoldenEye exists. A radiation surge that destroys everything with an electronic circuit.
You can still depend on one man.
I want you to find GoldenEye.
3.
Find who took it.
2.
And stop it.
1.
Name's Bond. James Bond.
That then was a clip from the trailer of 1995's GoldenEye, directed by Martin Campbell, screen story by Michael France, screenplay by Jeffrey Kane and Bruce Feirstein. Pierce Brosnan starring as James Bond 007, Sean Bean, Isabella Skorupko, Famke Janssen, Joe Don Baker, Judi Dench and Robbie Coltrane in the cast, along with Alan Cumming and Desmond Llewellyn and Samantha Bond and Michael Keaton. I could go on for quite a while with this cast list. A sizeable ensemble, as you would expect for a James Bond adventure. But then the expectations of a James Bond adventure were slightly different by the time we came to the mid-1990s, that this film, and it may seem hard to believe it looking back now, but this film was seen as a giant gamble, a real risk, that the movies before it in the James Bond saga, the Timothy Dalton headlined The Living Daylights and License to Kill, I've covered the latter before in a Film Stories episode, well, they'd got their fair selection of fans, of which I am one, but when it came to the box office, they weren't really setting the world alight. Nonetheless, after the release of License to Kill, there was speculation over whether Timothy Dalton would return eventually for a third outing as James Bond 007. But that was certainly the plan, that he would. And it was pretty well known that an adaptation of The Property of a Lady began in 1990. After the release of License to Kill, there had been decisions made, though, of a change of direction for the James Bond series. That License to Kill was seen as very dark. It had lost some of the wit. I think License to Kill is a real precursor to the Daniel Craig era. But there were key personnel changes, that director John Glenn, who directed the previous four or five movies in the saga, he was moving on. Richard Mayborn, who'd written the vast bulk of the James Bond screenplays, he wasn't going to return. And so the work was on just finding the people to sit in those seats. Now, I've drawn on a whole host of sources for researching this podcast. I should give credit to the excellent book Some Kind of Hero, The Remarkable Story of the James Bond Films by Matthew Field, A.J. Chowdhury. There are several interviews with Pierce Brosnan that I've been through. He recorded on YouTube earlier this year a full, effectively, Pierce Brosnan commentary of GoldenEye, I think, with Esquire magazine. The DVD's got an awful lot in there, and also a surprisingly good making of book by Garth Pierce, and I've drawn on those and a few other sources as well. The plan then was to get James Bond back in front of the cameras in 1990, 1 year after the release of License to Kill. I think this bit is all pretty well known, that the idea was start filming 1990, release the film in late 1991. However, rights problems came in due to the perilous financial status of MGM that was going through sale, and this brought with it, MGM being the parent company effectively of United Artists, this brought with it questions over exactly where the Bond rights sat. How much of them sat with Danjak, how much with United Artists, how much with MGM, Eon Productions as well. And it ended up with MGM doing a deal with Pathé where Pathé and MGM effectively merged together after Pathé bought the MGM name up. This went backwards and forwards. Danjak sued Pathé. The countersuits came in. The bottom line of this isn't a legal podcast, the bottom line is the James Bond series remained in limbo until the end of December 1992. By this stage, it had already been 3 years since we'd had a 007 adventure on the big screen, and it was going to take a couple of years to basically get a project up and running. And this is where the questions in earnest started about whether Timothy Dalton would return to play James Bond again. It remained the plan, and the film that was being put together had him in mind. Albert R. Broccoli, the legendary producer of the James Bond series, he was still interested, but effectively Timothy Dalton's contract was up, and so the word came out from him that he was considering moving on as well. Now, a further personnel change was behind the scenes as well. And I've just mentioned Albert R. Broccoli, known as Cubby in the industry. And he was at this point, his health was starting to decline, and he took a back seat, which meant that Barbara Broccoli, his daughter, and Michael G. Wilson were stepping up to be the lead producers on the new James Bond film. This would be the first time, really, that they had led a James Bond film from the front. They've been involved in lots of them, but the casting of Bond, all the bits and bobs to do with it, well, that was now on their plate as well. Still, that doesn't mean that Albert R. Broccoli didn't still have real influence, and he actually asked Timothy Dalton to reconsider returning to the role of James Bond, which Dalton was tempted to do, but he'd say in more recent interviews what ultimately put him off was the long-term commitment that Cubby was looking for. And Dalton would finally announce his resignation of the role in April of 1994. So we're still, this is 16 months after the rights problems had all been cleared up and there was no James Bond. That said, a lot of work had been done by that stage. That work on the script certainly was well underway, and the Bond team wasted little time once legalities were sorted in getting that up and running. In came Michael France, who'd co-written Cliffhanger, and he wanted the job. He'd had a meeting with the Bond production team in January 1993, And off the back of that, and he remained in regular contact with the Broccolis and with Michael G. Wilson, he penned the first draft of what would become GoldenEye, and that was ready in summer of 1993. And in putting the first draft of that script together, he did research trips to Russia, he interviewed KGB agents, and crucially, he was writing that screenplay with Timothy Dalton still in mind, nonetheless being steered towards a slightly lighter feel, with Goldfinger cited as a touch point, the kind of thing roughly to aim in the direction of. So that's aiming low, isn't it? Not. Now, once France had completed his screenplay, in came Jeffrey Kane to do a rewrite on it. Then in came Kevin Wade to do a polish on the rewrite that was done by Jeffrey Kane. But ultimately, it wasn't really tuned to where they wanted it to be until Bruce Feirstein came in. And he came in really late in the day, in truth, that he wasn't a massively experienced screenwriter, in that none of his films to that point had been given the green light. But he certainly he had a take, he had skill, and he had an in with the Bond team as well. And in September 1994, he was hired, with the core of his pitch being to the Broccolis that the world has changed and Bond hadn't. And it's worth noting that in the years that Bond had been away, the Berlin Wall had fallen, the politics of Europe was changing fast. And the Reagan Thatcher era was over, and Bond really needed to reflect that. So it was a far bigger than expected rewrite that Bruce Feirstein ultimately did on GoldenEye. It was his suggestion, for instance, making the character of M female, which paved the way to Judi Dench in this one. But also there's some really sizable work that he did even beyond that. Now, while the script was being written, there's a small matter of who's going to direct the thing. Well, John Glenn wasn't, that much was clear. And so they knew really that they wanted things to be a bit different this time. That United Artists, they brought in an executive by the name of John Calley, who was going to oversee large parts of the project. The studio, thus, United Artists, was pushing for a different tone. People who were considered, Michael Caton-Jones, who did Scandal, and Memphis Belle, he's just done a film called Our Ladies, which is coming up soon as well. It's been held up in limbo. That's really worth seeking out as well. Peter Medak done The Craze and Let Him Have It, and they were both said to be candidates for the James Bond role. But it was Calley who put forward the name of Martin Campbell. Now, Martin Campbell had sprung to prominence as a television director in the 80s. He made the hugely acclaimed TV series Edge of Darkness, for instance, which he also brought to the big screen sometime later. But what really also gravitated them to him was a prison escape movie of the early 90s that wasn't The Mighty Fortress. I love Fortress. No, it was No Escape, starring Ray Liotta. Remember that one? And what Calley was taken by was the fact that Campbell had taken a $20 million budget and made the thing look a lot more expensive than it was. And this goes back to the challenge that they had with GoldenEye, in that the world of cinema had changed. Bond had no right with a new film to be a huge event, certainly not in the way that we've seen it now and the way it had seen in the past. Bond had to earn its place again. And so the budget was, I mean, it wasn't cheap, but it was going to be done on a $60 million budget. And that was relatively modest by mid-90s standards, certainly if you're talking about blockbuster cinema as well. And that dollar was going to have to be stretched. It had to give the public the perception that this was a gigantic film, even though it's been mitigated by you know, sizable risks and sizable doubts about whether James Bond would remain relevant. I mean, one of the articles I found while I was researching this was a set report visit that was in Premiere magazine that came out around the time. And it's really snippy, really snippy. And it goes to the fact that the writer seemed to go in with the perception that James Bond was out of date and this is all really silly. And that was not an uncommon viewpoint when GoldenEye was being made. So anyway, going back to Martin Campbell, a meeting was arranged with him, a New Zealander, the first time someone from New Zealand would direct a Bond film. By this stage, John Woo, the mighty John Woo, had turned the job down. But Campbell was more tempted, and he signed up in 1994 with a race against time to get the film to the screen. And there was one demand he was quite insistent on, in that he wanted the script locked before filming began. This has not happened so much in recent times on Bond movies. movies. I mean, particularly Spectre. You go back to what Sam Mendes has said. If you go to the Team Deakins website, Sam Mendes talked about on Spectre about how he had to start shooting without the final third of the film determined. Campbell was in a position, and also the Bond franchise was in a position where he would have none of that. He was able to ask for that. And again, walking in with lower expectations, Bond had the flexibility, really, that if need be, they could delay the film to get it right, which ultimately is what they did. Because GoldenEye was originally going to come out in the summer of 1995. But the rewrites and the search for a director and the search for a Bond, well, they pushed it back to the end of 1995. That was fairly quickly agreed. Also, though, it's worth noting that that gave it a bit more distance from another film I've previously covered in Film Story on Film Stories podcast, True Lies, which had come out the summer of 1994. And I remember loads of press around the time of True Lies was, this has taken on James Bond's mantle, this has changed the rules for James Bond, how is James Bond going to react to that? Because of course, by that point, by the time True Lies came out, it was known that a new James Bond film was in the works, but True Lies, with a far bigger budget, was now playing on similar turf, and how on earth could Bond measure up to that? Well, one way they could try and change and adapt was in the casting of the new 007, which would give the film an initial blast of publicity. How much, they weren't quite sure. Now, several names were considered. Mel Gibson was said to have been considered. I mean, there's lots of rumoury stuff online about how he was offered $15 million to be James Bond. This was Mel Gibson at the height of his movie star powers as well in the 90s. Hugh Grant had risen to prominence in the 90s, of course, and he was said to be on the list. Can't quite see it myself, but, you know, fair dues. Debbie McWilliams, she was the casting director, and she's quoted in the making of book as saying she considered 10 actors in all. Liam Neeson was believed to be one of them. Martin Campbell said to have at least interviewed Ralph Fiennes, who had sprung to attention off the back of his stunning supporting role in Schindler's List a year or two before. And it got to the point where Martin Campbell was interviewing potential James Bonds throughout May of 1994, and they needed to make their call. They really needed to make their decision. Now, one person who didn't screen test for the role was Pierce Brosnan, but of course Brosnan had form here. It's a very well-known story that Brosnan was originally cast for The Living Daylights, and then a commitment to the TV show Remington Steele meant he had to relinquish the role of Bond, and in came Timothy Dalton. This time, I mean, Albert R. Broccoli was still keen on Brosnan. In fact, he pushed for him. United Artists were also pushing for him. And ultimately, Brosnan got the call on the 1st of June 1994. No screen test. He was committed to go and do a film of Robinson Crusoe that he had to fit in as well. But this time, he was definitely going to be James Bond. He was in his early 40s, and he got the second chance that he dreamed of. Now, he had a very small period of time for the press launch. I think he had a day or so where he could be in London for it before he went off to shoot the Robinson Crusoe movie, sporting a beard that would not be part of his James Bond look. And he took to the stage at the Regent Hotel in London. And this was the official relaunch of Bond. Barbara Broccoli was nervous. Brosnan was being presented to the world for the first time as 007. And would people be interested? Well, any doubt that they were was soon extinguished by that press conference and the aftermath of it. And Brosnan's talked in interviews since about how the following day he was in newspapers around the world. People had started digging into his private life. The casting of a new James Bond, at the very least, was still very big news. Whether the film would be, well, that was the challenge ahead. The rest of the casting came together once Brosnan was in place. Famke Janssen, she came to the production's attention off the back of the film Lord of Illusions, based on the writing of Clive Barker. This was another United Artists movie that hadn't actually been released at that point, but obviously they were able to take a look. And she was cast in, went in to read, did a scene with Brosnan on the casino set, and was duly cast in the film. Sean Bean, he came to attention. I mean, he bubbled up off the back of the TV TV show Sharp in particular in the early 90s. He was making When Saturday Comes at the time, and he landed Goldeneye. For M, there were a couple of considerations there, but again, it was John Calley who suggested Judi Dench, others being in the frame, but she was clearly the top choice. And then Desmond Llewellyn with a crumpled suit would come along to provide continuity from previous to new Bond. Further continuity behind the camera as well. Production designer Peter Lamont would come back for the 15th time. He wasn't expecting to. He thought Martin Campbell would bring in his own people. He was delighted to get the call, not least because he'd been working on True Lies with James Cameron just before that. And also returning for the last time, sadly, was the brilliant Derek Meddings, who was doing the miniature work of which Goldeneye relies extensively on. Alan Cumming, he came in, Samantha Bott, the cast was rounded out. And by 16th of January 1995, filming was ready to begin. This was 10, 11 months before the film was going to be in cinemas. As always with James Bond productions, it was going to be a mighty race against time. Now, when it came to actually shooting the film, the immediate problem was there was no room to do it. That Pinewood Studios is the natural home of James Bond movies. License to Kill hadn't been at Pinewood for an assortment of reasons. And now it was none of Goldeneye was going to be able to shoot there. It looked like too. The problem, ironically enough, was Sean Connery, the late Sean Connery. He was shooting a film called First Night for director Jerry Zucker, co-starring Richard Gere, and that had booked up the stages at Pinewood, so that was pressing ahead. And so they happened upon an old Rolls-Royce factory in Leavesden, around the Watford area, just north of London. Now, this was not a film studio, but it was a massive space with which they would be able to do pretty much what they wanted. In then came Peter Lamont and his team, and they had about 8 weeks to turn this old factory site into a film studio. And that studio became Leavesden, and Leavesden has in subsequent years now been taken on by Warner Brothers, and it's where you find the Harry Potter studio tour now, and it's Warner Brothers basically UK studio. Brosnan liked the fact that they were shooting somewhere completely different. He talked about the fact that there were no ghosts of previous Bond movies on those sets, although Roger Moore would pop in for a visit a couple of months, well, just a few days before the end of production. The Leavesden site got the nickname Cubbywood after Albert R. Broccoli, and shooting was ready to go ahead. Now, Goldeneye starts with a real statement of intense sequence, a massive bungee jump 220 meters down the Contra Dam in Switzerland, which is where it's shot. And Brosnan told the story of this bungee jump in that aforementioned live stream I was talking about before, and how they tested the jump by basically cutting a tree log to the weight of the stuntman to give it and then attaching that to the end of the bungee rope, dropping it and seeing what happens, because there was a curve really to the dam. It wasn't a straight drop, and the first couple of times they did it, the tree smashed straight into the wall. This led to inevitable changes in how they went about this. Notably, they had to look for the right weather. They had to wait for exactly the right day, because if it was too windy, there was no way that this shot could be done. It was Wayne Michaels who agreed to do the stunt. Several people turned the job down, and in the end, he had to do that jump twice for the start of the film. Because as the point was made, Martin Campbell makes the point that it wasn't just that he had to do the jump, he had to do a bit of acting as he did it. He has to pull a gun out of a holster midway through this tremendous fall. He did it. Pierce Brosnan did the close-up stuff, and this incredible opening, which is still regarded as one of the best stunts in a James Bond movie, was duly in the can. What wasn't in the can, and it wouldn't be until the month after, was Brosnan saying the iconic line for the first time, "Bond, James Bond." There, you can have a Brummy version of that just for you. And he'd been really nervous to say this. He's, whether superstitious or not, he refused to say it at the press conference. He wouldn't say it. The first time he says it with people listening, was going to be on a casino set built at Leavesden when the sequence in question would be shot. And he was quite nervous about it. But, and I've written about this more recently on the Film Stories website, there was a little bit of a helping hand there, because one of the extras in the background of the casino shot was Kate Gayson, who's the daughter of Eunice Gayson, who was opposite Sean Connery in a casino shot in the first James Bond movie, Dr. No. And what Kate Gayson told Pierce Brosnan was just how nervous Sean Connery was saying the line for the first time, to the point where the director of Dr. No, Terence Young, basically got Eunice Gayson to take Sean Connery to the pub at lunchtime. Sean Connery had a few snifters, came back and was able to land the line. But Brosnan was assured by the fact that if Connery was nervous, then fair dues. I mean, there's nothing wrong really with him being nervous either. He duly got the shot in a very dialogue heavy day of filming on the 13th of February 1995. The production went to Monte Carlo, went to Puerto Rico, went to Russia, went around the UK, went to Epsom Racecourse as well, which doubled for St. Petersburg Airport. St. Petersburg as a location was causing problems. The second unit of the film went there. Barbara Broccoli went there as well. But there were complexities with dealing with Russian authorities, which meant a big tank chase that they intended to do. Well, they decided the easiest thing to do was to recreate St. Petersburg at Leavesden, which is what they did to such a convincing way that some members of the Russian media were reporting that the Bond film had trashed quite a lot of their stuff, when actually it had just been a very good replication matched up to second unit footage. Martin Campbell's set is worth noting too. Well, that was efficient. He certainly earned praise from Desmond Llewellyn for one. He said, Llewellyn quoted in the Some Kind of Hero book, says, "We had more rehearsal time than I'd ever had in my life." And Judy Dench, of course, said the same. Llewellyn said, "If we didn't get something right in the scene, he'd reshoot it completely. Most of my other directors would cut around and insert, but not him." Llewellyn, as always, he had his lines written out on cue cards for him that Michael Wilson was holding up. But Brosnan too talked about the intensity of shooting GoldenEye and how Campbell marshalled it, and it sounded like it was quite testing at times. But there does seem to be quite a lot of mutual respect going on between the actors and the director. Now, editing, as is the norm, was underway as GoldenEye was still shooting. Terry Rawlings was the editor of this one. Filming finally wrapped up on June the 2nd, with the movie set to premiere in November, and that was a real race against time to get the film ready. This is the era, as I say, oftentimes, where film was still distributed in cans of film. So a more time intensive process to duplicate that film, to transport the cans all around the country in the quantities required. While the editing was going on, it's worth noting that an offer went into legendary composer John Barry. He's got no shortage of form with the James Bond saga, after all, to score the new movie, but he turned this one down. Off the back of his work with Luc Besson on films like Leon, in came Eric Serra to do the film. And it's quite a divisive score that he put together. John Altman came in and did some work on it as well. When it came to the title song, the offer went to the Rolling Stones to see if they wanted to record the title song to GoldenEye. They turned that down, and instead the producers went with a song written by Bono and The Edge, sung by Tina Turner. That was the one that ultimately is the title track. There's another song running over the end credits as well, but the music was in place. Now, there was still a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing that the Writers Guild of America arbitrated on the screen credits and denied Michael France anything other than a story by credit, which he wasn't really best pleased with. He's talked about that since. There was also a battle with the ratings board as well, in that this Bond had to, and mid-90s, it wasn't quite as crucial as it perhaps is now in blockbuster cinema, but they wanted this to go out with a PG-13 in the US and a 12A in the UK, or a 12 in the UK as it was then. This did require some jiggery-pokery, though, and cuts had to be made to the film to basically get that rating. That bullet impacts were taken out, some deaths were cut back, and the movie, I mean, subsequently in the US, it's still the, I understand it's still the cut version that you can buy. In the UK, finally, the disc version was, the cuts were reinstated, I think, in the 2000s. So the disc version that you can get here now is 15 certificate, but when it came out, it got the 12 that they were after. Now, by this stage, a first test screening had taken place in July of 1995, just a month after filming had finished. The word on the movie was good, and the word from Cubby Broccoli was good too, that his health by this stage was in real decline, but he saw the rushes, he was impressed with what he saw, and he was impressed with Pierce Brosnan as James Bond as well, as the rest of the world ultimately would be too. Unusually for a Bond movie, this one debuted in the US first, that it had its US premiere on the 13th of November 1995, opening on the 17th, just 4 days later. The UK premiere wouldn't be till over a week later on the 21st of November, and it got its wide release in the UK on the 24th of November. Pretty much every Bond film since has reversed that, and the reviews were really quite good. Certainly the reviews for Brosnan was, people were taken with the fact that he was a lighter James Bond than Timothy Dalton had been, but also there was a real acceptance that this was a Bond series that had modernised, that had found a new place in the world, and that was a very, very tricky uphill task that it faced. Crucially too, the film was a box office success, and this was a box office success of the ilk the James Bond series hadn't seen for a long time. That its opening weekend in America, well, it opened to $26 million, which by mid-90s standards was great anyway, but by the standards of the gold, of the Bond films, well, that was really something. To put it into context, the number two film of that week was Ace Ventura: When Nature Calls, where Goldeneye knocked that down to from the top spot. The American President opened at three, It Takes Two was at four, Get Shorty at five, others in there, Copycat, Home for the Holidays, seven was still around, Now and Then also in there. But the film, whilst it would go on to gross over $100 million in the US, it just crept over that. In the UK, well, it was even more successful, and this was very much that the James Bond film was back up and running. Its worldwide gross in the end would be $352 million, and that's pretty much grown with every movie since, barring one or two exceptions. But the Bond was now not just back, but Bond was a huge blockbuster franchise. And also, it's worth noting, a really good Nintendo 64 game regarded as a bit of a classic. For all concerned, well, Derek Meddings would not see the final cut of the movie. He died in post-production, and the film is dedicated to him and his incredible work. And Martin Campbell paid tribute to the fact that they couldn't have realised what they wanted to do on GoldenEye in an era where computer effects were very much in their infancy, without Meddings' input. Campbell declined the chance to return to direct, at least he wouldn't, until Daniel Craig came along and Casino Royale was greenlit. I'll come to that in a future podcast. Brosnan, he would move on just 2 years later. Tomorrow Never Dies would be on the screen. In between the release of GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies, Albert R. Broccoli sadly passed away. Since then, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson have taken the Bond series forward. I will come to the story of Tomorrow Never Dies also in a future podcast. But in terms of a franchise reboot, when people look at that, what was achieved with GoldenEye, what, 25 years on, really is quite something. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest film stories. I am a fully independent publisher, so can I ask favours, please? If you like this podcast, please do subscribe at your podcast repository of choice. It does make a difference to indies like me. Likewise, if you can leave ideally a hugely positive review, that would be amazing. Also, if you'd be kind enough to buy my magazines or spread the word of them, that would be terrific as well. Go to store.filmstories.co.uk. I've just sent to print the 21st issue of Film Stories magazine, which is now 2 years old, which makes me feel very old. All the back issues, some Christmas subscription deals, all sorts on the website now. And with that, I'm going to come to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode. I'll play you a clip, come to the story the other side of this.
Who are your influences?
Barry Manilow.
Who are your influences?
Joan Baez, Joni Mitchell.
Wings. Backman Toner Overdrive.
Bandau Ballet. Soft Cell.
Sinead O'Connor.
Bob Bettonite. Trip to a candy shop. Where?
Hi, I've come about the audition.
Led Zeppelin.
Billy and the Bollocks.
You too?
That then was a clip from 1991's The Commitments, directed by Alan Parker, based on the novel by Roddy Doyle. A screenplay by Dick Clement, Ian Lafrenne and Roddy Doyle. The cast included primarily unknowns at the time. Robert Arkins, Michael Ahern, Angeline Ball, Maria Doyle Kennedy, Dave Finnegan, Brona Gallagher, Col Meaney in there, Glenn Hansard, Johnny Murphy as Joey the Lips Fagan, and some of the cores. I'll be coming to them shortly. Now, the story of this one, well, it goes back to Roddy Doyle's novel. To call it a novel is probably overselling it a bit. Novella, I think most have agreed to call it, because he wrote a very slim book in 1987, The Commitments. And what Doyle wanted to do with that book, well, he's a teacher and he wanted to write a film about basically a band bringing a bunch of young characters together. And he wanted a lot of characters in his film. And as a consequence, that influenced the kind of band that he wanted to put in the book. He decided he wanted it to be a soul band because that would allow it to be much bigger. That would allow him to bring more characters in. The book was published in 1987 and was read by several people, one of whom was producer by the name of Roger Randall Cutler, who'd had a success with the film Dance with a Stranger at this point. And he optioned the novella fairly quickly with a view of turning it into a movie. Now, that novella he then passed on to the writing duo of Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenne. And it went to Lafrenne first, who passed it to Clement. They'd got Porridge and The Likely Lads, their name at this point. They'd broken into films with the film Water, for instance. And they would go on to do The Bank Job, which I've talked about them before on this podcast. And Cutler told them that at this point it was going to be a very low budget film done on a shoestring. As a consequence, the script would have to be done on the cheap. But they agreed because they loved it. They liked the they thought the dialogue and the characters made up for the lack of plot, and they laughed heavily at the book when they read it. But also what they had in their corner at that point was no need for the money, because they'd done a deal with a man called Bill Mark, a Texas financier. And Mark was putting together a $30 million-ish production company with backing from overseas investors, mysterious overseas investors, as it would happen. And he wanted Dick and Ian on board. And they talk about this in their memoir, which is well worth digging out. It's called More Than Likely. And the Commitments seemed like just the kind of project that could form part of this new film fund that they suddenly had access to. And so they told Bill Mark they wanted to write the screenplay. They to quote from the book, we flew back to Los Angeles on Pan Am. And then they talk about introducing the project to Alan Parker. Now, the late director Alan Parker, terrific director, of course, he had fame to his name at this point. He'd done the U2 movie. He was making the film Come See the Paradise and Mississippi Burning. He was dealing with very big Hollywood productions really at this stage in his career. But they had lunch with Alan Parker in Hollywood. They told Alan Parker about the fact that Bill Mark had given them this basically development fund they could work with, and that they had, quote, a sudden and unexpected ability to finance movies. When we mentioned The Commitments, his eyes lit up. Why don't I do that one? Said Parker, and there it was. It was that simple. Now, it's worth noting at the time that Alan Parker, I mean, he'd been offered Evita a few years before, which he wouldn't do for some time to come, but he was also due to do the Les Miserables movie, which didn't come to pass at that point. But he opted to do The Commitments. He wanted to do this. He'd been fighting logistical problems on the films he'd been making in America, and he picked up that novella and talked about how he laughed out loud at the book and kind of figured people might laugh out loud at the film as well. So Bill Mark was happy, because now there's an Oscar-nominated director, there's a project, and this was something they could press ahead with, and on they went. And the problem is, Bill Mark got vaguer and vaguer and vaguer, and getting in contact with him was trickier for Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenne. That the funding to, they kept being told that the funding to finance movies was apparently still there. They ended up communicating a lot of the time with him via fax, of these pre-internet times, of course. Parker confirmed that he wanted in, but Bill Mark kept disappearing at the point they needed him. So the suspicions of Clement and Lafrenne, well, they were on the up. And over the course of 2 months, they were chasing backwards and forwards, messages going backwards and forth. But they finally met him in an office in London, in a posh boardroom that they were reassured by. They were less reassured when they went back the following day to follow up and he wasn't there. And they suspected that he'd basically rented the office for the day. Bill Maher, if you're listening, feel free to put your side of the story. I'm presenting these as allegations. Call your lawyers off. So at this point, Clement and Lafrenne, they were just, every alarm bell was going. This had cost them money to get to this point, and they decided it was the cut your losses time. That while Mark was still insistent he could get the funding for the film, a friend of Lafrenne and Clement by the name of Mark Abraham, well, he was a writer who'd just been started working with a new company that had been set up called Beacon Pictures, didn't have anywhere near the vast reservoirs of money, but their money actually existed. So, you know, quid pro quo. Beacon was looking for films, the name of the commitments was dropped, and an offer came in, and that was the one that all concerned decided to go with. They decided to cut their many losses and go with a much lower, but far more reliable offer. Fox would pick up the American rights to the film. It's going to cost around $10 million to make this, but part and parcel of the film being done on a relatively low budget was Alan Parker, for his part, would get creative control. With that in mind, off they went to work on the script. That Roddy Dahl penned the original draft of the script. Then in came Dick Clement and Ian Lafrenne. They put together their version of it, and then they met up with Alan Parker in Dublin to write the final draft. And they talk in their memoir about how Parker challenged them right from the first scene, and how Parker said, "You've put it in house, which is picturesque and on the sea. Movies establish their credentials in the first 5 minutes," argued Parker. "We need to begin with something gritty and working class." And the setting of The Commitments was, well, it's Barrytown is the given setting, but it was going to be filmed in and around Dublin. It was going to be a working class story of people trying to escape their lives, really, through music. And whilst Parker wasn't Irish, he did grow up working class and really could relate to the fact of trying to make something more for themselves through music in this particular case. The market that I just talked about, that would need to be specially staged for the movie. But I'm jumping a little bit ahead, because then Alan Parker went to see the bands playing Soul in Dublin that he'd worked out fairly as they weren't working on a huge budget. So as a consequence, they weren't going to get big movie stars. So I'll come to that shortly. And so it was going to be a cast of unknowns for this one. And he worked out that the best way round is, rather than teaching actors to be musicians, he's better off finding primarily musicians and trying to get them to be actors. He describes it as having to cast the film. He talks about it extensively on the excellent Blu-ray release that came out a couple of years ago. He talks about authenticity being the absolute key for this one. In an interview with the New York Times at the time, actually, he said ultimately the people that cast had to be pretty close to the kinds of personalities they already had, so they're not playing roles outside of themselves. He could see the limitations of trying to turn musicians into actors, and thus wanted them to act really as little as he could get away with. He toured Dublin watching dozens, possibly hundreds of bands in doing so, and he was also at the same point narrowing down the list of the songs that he wanted in the movie. He got it down, first of all, of a list of 70 possible songs, took them into rehearsal before narrowing them down to the songs that we end up with the film. And then it was the case of the auditions. And the auditions were pretty open. I mean, Parker talks about how it was the women who were more gutsy than the guys on the whole in the auditions. He talks too about and how they found Andrew Strong, who takes on the role of Deco in the movie, that an Irish soul singer by the name of Rob Song was being used to help with the auditions. And he happened to bring along his son, Andrew, and as it was described, Andrew Strong sang for them, and it was a voice that shouldn't have come out of a 16-year-old. And at this point, Robert Arkins was in line to take the role of Deco, the lead singer of The Commitments, but Andrew Strong's performance changed everything. So Arkins found himself in the role of Jimmy Rabbit, and as a consequence, doesn't actually sing in the movie, which is why he gets to sing the song that's over the opening credits of the film. Clement and Lafrenet, once they saw Strom, they would rewrite the script and change the character of Deco quite a lot to accommodate the fact that this singer had come in and just completely sideswiped them in terms of the expectation of what they had and what they could do, really. The open call auditions took place in the town hall at Dublin. 1,500 people turned up playing all sorts of instruments. Around 300, a shortlist of 300 was then put together. And Parker had to pick 10 people from those. But also he would use some of the people who didn't make it in the background of the film. And, you know, the audition scenes that you see in the movie as well. He would use some people in and around that. The auditions weren't, as Clement and Lafrenet talk about, weren't actually that different from what you see for the auditions in the film. And they describe them as a riotous succession of actors, musicians, misfits and the unemployed parading their talents and pedigrees. A 60-ish male showed up for the part of horn-playing veteran Joey the Lips. He held a stained, battered trumpet in his hand, and Alan Parker asked him how long he'd been playing, and quote, the old timer replied, "I bought it on the way here." Now, there had been pressure in the midst of it all, not least because they wanted to sell this film in America, to add a movie star to the lineup. So the character of Joey the Lips, actually, Bob Hoskins was considered at one point. Michael Caine's name was also mentioned. Now, Van Morrison was sent a script and agreed to have a meeting about the role as well. And at that meeting, well, it didn't really go well. And the meeting, Van Morrison's manager apparently demanded breakfast before there'd even been a hello. And quote, Van thought it would make much more sense if the kids played his music, not soul. And going back to Clement and Lafrenet talking about this, they said perhaps he had a valid point. But as he also found our script, quote, shite, unquote, there didn't seem much point pursuing the issue. Although Van Morrison apparently offered his music to the film, but the idea of using a star name at that point, and Michael Caine had been mentioned as well, but the idea of using a star name, well, it was quietly dropped at that point. Once the cast was in place, there were 5 weeks of rehearsals ahead, and it was primarily musicians. There were only a couple of people who'd acted before. So Johnny Murphy, stage actor, came in to play Joey the Lips. Carl Meany, who'd been working with Parker on Come See the Paradise, which he'd made immediately before The Commitments, he was in. And Broder Gallagher had done some acting work as well. Lafrenet talks about how he wishes they could turn back time to be in the Dublin rehearsal room for the first time the script was read, and then how everyone went to the pub later that night. The jokes were coming thick and fast, and the camaraderie, really, of the movie was quickly coming together. This was not going to be a film set with lots of trailers and people working in luxury. They were going to have to work hard, and this was a cast and crew that were going to be milling around together for several weeks. During the first week of reading and rehearsal, one trick Parker did just to try and make the new cast feel less self-conscious was he asked them to keep switching the scripts and read other people's roles, even if it meant they were reading the roles of different gender, just to try and put a bit more fun and a bit more challenge into the process. And it also allowed Clement and Lafrenet sat in on that process and would rewrite as actors stroke musicians became more and more familiar with their roles. And it finally got to a point where filming was ready to begin on the 27th of August 1990, and this was some time still before the release of the movie. Ironically, they had more of a build up on The Commitments than they did on Goldeneye. Because he was working with untrained actors, and this goes to an interview that Parker gave to the New York Times, it describes how Parker developed a directing strategy. And he said every single line, every single movement, every single thing you're doing is to encourage them to be themselves so that they don't know they're acting. And so Robert Arkins talked about this, and said, he was asked, did Alan Parker give him any tips on acting? And he said, no, he let me do it himself. Much the approval of Parker, who overheard him saying that. Parker would say he worked harder with Arkins than anyone else because he saw him as the pivotal character. But there was lots of effort behind the scenes to make it look as natural as it all did. in particular with the music, that Parker had a lot of experience filming music, of course, and this would not be the last time he did it on film either, but he wanted to shoot the music live. He knew to make it feel real, he had to do it that way. And there were around 60 musical cues in all in the film, and there was a shadow band on hand to perform the songs as they should be, to work with the actors as well. But he knew if this film was going to be raw, if it's going to be gutsy, that there couldn't be a backing track. He talks about this extensively on that disc release I was talking about, and that it had to be done for real, which is duly what happened. And in all, the film would then shoot, as well as those musical numbers, it would shoot in 44 different locations around Dublin. There are very few sets. Most of it is location. The Jimmy Rabbit's house you see in the film was built, a small set was built in a Dublin studio for that. But the idea was take it around the city and put that on screen, which duly what happened. And ultimately the rap party would be a raucous affair celebrating the end of production. It was held in Dublin, and the Commitments performed a set, as they did when the film went and premiered in New York and Los Angeles. And at the Los Angeles premiere, Wilson Pickett joined them for a couple of numbers as well. One story about the Los Angeles premiere that Clement and Lafrenne talk about is that Alan Parker held a party for the cast and crew in his Los Angeles home, and to quote the book, a memorable moment came after heartthrob Liam Neeson, as he was described then, joined the girls in the jacuzzi and the drink flowed. Brona Gallagher raised her glass to the sun-bleached California sky. "I can't trucking believe this," she sort of said. "I'm drinking tequila in a hot tub in Hollywood and Liam Neeson has his hand on me thigh." Yet, even in post-production, just to get to the point where they could debut the film in Los Angeles, it had taken a lot of work to get there. Not least in the promotion of the movie, that one of the things that Fox wanted to do was stage basically a platform release in the US. If you're not familiar with the term, this means instead of you blanket book your film onto thousands of screens, you build it up in a number of cities. You have to strike fewer prints as a result. It's more economical, but it's absolutely reliant as a consequence on word of mouth. And thus, with the film not due to open until the summer of 1991, what happened was 20th Century Fox in the US, they started quietly promoting it in February of 91. They started arranging preview screenings in key cities around the US in the April of that year. And then they kind of, they tried to take advantage of the music, and not unreasonably so. And so they were working with radio stations and DJs and really putting across the strong musical side of the movie. Ultimately, the film would debut in America on the 6th of August 1991 in Hollywood, and then it would get a wide release the week after, and that platform release would build from that point. The UK, we wouldn't actually get the film until a month or two later, that the British release of the movie was the 4th of October, same date as the Irish release of it. And the reviews for this one, well, they were good. They were good. That the sheer heart, really, of the film was deemed to be very much on screen. The music, too, came in inevitably for sizable acclaim. In fact, the soundtrack album of The Commitments would go on to be a bestseller, to the point where a volume 2 would follow not long afterwards. But also there was general satisfaction with the movie from those who'd made it. And Alan Parker talked to Robert Emery for the book The Directors, take 3, and he said, "I like The Commitments because I enjoyed doing it. If it turned out to be a really rotten film, it wouldn't have mattered to me because I had such a good time doing it. But I think it's nice for what it is, and I think that a lot of people have tried to copy it, perhaps not satisfactorily. It has vitality and energy and honesty." And I think it's quite a raw film. I was trying to be unpretentious as I possibly could be as an artist in doing it. The fact that I enjoy doing it so much, I think it does have a good spirit. The spirit comes from the kids themselves, and hopefully that shows up on the screen. It showed up afterwards as well, in that the young cast, well, there was demand for them to go out and perform, and Andrew Strong would go off and do solo touring, and The Commitments have done various gigs, and they did come back together for gigs as well a bit more recently. But also it helped launch musical careers too. All four members of The Corrs, for instance, had small parts in The Commitments. It was the first time they'd worked together, and the music coordinator of The Commitments, a man called John Hughes, but not that one, became The Corrs' his manager, Glenn Hansard, meanwhile. Well, he'd apparently struggled to get on with Alan Parker on the set of the film, but years later, he would become an Oscar winner. That he would share the Oscar for Best Song for the film Once, in which he co-starred. That would become a Broadway and West End hit. John Carney wrote and produced that movie. In terms of the commitments itself, well, that was a box office success too, against the limitations of its budget. We're not talking GoldenEye level, but the film in America alone would go on and do about $14 million. It was a small release by the standards of movies. I mean, Terminator 2 was still at the box office by the time the commitments made it into American cinemas, but it's grown and grown and grown subsequent to its release as well. And whilst I think it's probably too popular to call it a cult hit, it's one that regularly gets airing and regularly gets new catalogue releases as well. It would also get an Oscar nomination for Best Film Editing, and the musical legacy of it goes on. There was talk at one point about doing a sequel. Harvey Weinstein, now a convicted rapist, in January 2000, picked up the screen rights for a sequel to The Commitments and commissioned a script to make Commitments to. That would have seen the band going on tour in America with new band members. That never happened. What did happen in the more immediate aftermath of the first film was a baritone trilogy based on Roddy Doyle's books, so The Snapper and The Van. They would make it to the screen. They'd be quite different films from The Commitments, and they would be BBC productions that debuted on television. And then there was the musical of The Commitments, which originally Clement and Lafrenne wanted to write it, but ultimately Roddy Doyle had the rights to this, and he would write the book for a stage musical of The Commitments, which would go on to be a sizable success as well. Which all leads really to a film made on a modest budget, made with real heart, that's had a sizable legacy to it and continues to have a sizable legacy to it. And it's telling, I mean, we lost Sir Alan Parker earlier this year, as this has been recorded, and a very sad loss too. And it's telling that in amongst his extensive range of film credits, The Commitments kept coming up as one that was particularly loved. I think it's a fine tribute to him, and it's telling that it's the film that he enjoyed. He would say he enjoyed doing the most. I really think it's a smashing piece of work too, and it's always, always good value for a sing-song as well. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. You can find far more of my waffling than you ever want to hear on Twitter at Simon Brew, the whole Film Stories project at Film Stories Pod, but also our website, filmstories.co.uk, where we're putting up every weekday new Film Stories features and new stories and reviews and all sorts of mayhem going on there. You can find us on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories, on Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, and you can buy our entire back catalogue of magazines and subscriptions, that's Film Stories Magazine, Film Stories Junior Magazine, at store.filmstories.co.uk. All that leaves me to say is, as always, the most important thing is you, that you're okay, that you look after yourselves. I thank you so much for listening, and thank you for supporting my work. I'll be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Until then, you all take care of yourselves. Take care. Bye-bye.